This is VOA News. I'm Nicole Libous. U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic forces say they've begun an assault against Islamic State to clear the last enclave the militant group controls in eastern Syria. SDF spokesman Mustafa Bali tweeted Saturday, SDF started to move on to the last village remaining under jihadist control, village of Baghouz, which is the only remaining.
This battle will be sealed in the coming days.
SDF officials and the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights estimate there were about 3,000 battle-hardened Islamic State jihadists, mostly foreigners, in the region. The observatory also estimated several hundred civilians remained in the area. South Korea and the U.S. signed a new preliminary agreement Sunday, increasing the amount Seoul will pay for having U.S. troops there. South Korea will pay about $890 million under the new short-term agreement, which could push the two countries back to the bargaining table in just a few months. Timothy Betts is acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Negotiations and Agreements.
The United States government realizes that Korea does a lot for our alliance and for peace and stability in this region. And the SMA is only a small part of that, but it's an important part.
SMA stands for Special Measures Agreement. It must be approved by South Korea's parliament. Thousands of Spaniards joined a right-wing rally in Madrid on Sunday to demand that socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez step down. The conservative opposition Popular Party and the center-right Citizens Party organized the rally, which was also backed by the upstart far-right Vox and others. They claim Sanchez must resign for holding talks with separatists in the northeastern region of Catalonia. Egypt's president Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been elected chairman of the African Union at the Continental's summit in Ethiopia. Amnesty International warned his chairmanship might undermine the African Union's human rights mechanisms. This is VOA News. With Brexit just 47 days away, the British government is asking lawmakers to give Prime Minister Theresa May more time to rework her divorce deal with the European Union. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde warned about Brexit challenges at the Dubai government summit on Sunday.
There's certain things that they can't get ready for it because it's going to be, you know, physically difficult. Give you an example. Some of the boats that arrive in Calais will be having a hard time arriving in Southampton. So you don't shorten the queue by diverting the traffic. You have to fix the platforms.
The promise is a bid to avert a showdown on Thursday when Parliament is set to vote on the next moves. Britain is due to leave the EU on March 29th. The lawyer for the National Enquirer's parent company said Sunday the tabloid committed neither extortion nor blackmail by threatening to publish intimate photos of Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. Bezos has said American Media Inc. threatened to publish the pictures unless he stopped investigating how the Enquirer obtained his private exchanges with his mistress Lauren Sanchez and publicly declared that the coverage of him was not politically motivated. Elkan Abramowitz represents AMI's chief executive. He was a guest on ABC's This Week.
That is not extortion because all that AMI wanted was the truth. Bezos and Ms. Sanchez knew who the source was. Any investigator that was going to investigate this knew who the source was. It was not the White House. It was not Saudi Arabia.
He said a reliable source, well known to Bezos and his mistress, provided the story about the affair. President Trump has been highly critical of Bezos over his ownership of The Washington Post and Amazon and the Post coverage of the White House. The U.S. government faces a Friday deadline for funding, trying to avert another shutdown after a record 35-day closure ended last month. Construction money for a barrier at the southern border with Mexico remains at the center of the dispute, with President Trump asking for $5.7 billion and Democrats apparently ready to offer some money, but much less than what the president wants. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told NBC News on Sunday, another shutdown absolutely cannot be ruled out. He said whether lawmakers are close to reaching a deal depends on who you listen to. The president has said he could declare a national emergency to build a wall without congressional approval by tapping funds approved for other projects. But key Republican lawmakers have warned the president not to do that. Mr. Trump is set to travel to the border at El Paso, Texas, for a rally on Monday night to focus on his demands for that wall to curb illegal migrants from entering the U.S. I'm Nicole Libous, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Klote is away on assignment.
Those that will continue to challenge the state, our security, and form of the population are going to be treated accordingly. Soon as the situation will come back to normalcy in our region.
Over 60 people are killed as fighting resumes in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon.
My message to Nigerian people, to vote to your rights. I don't tell anybody make you choose ABC, but make you choose anything. Try the thing you have in your mind.
Campaigns in high gear as Nigerians prepare for this Saturday's general election.
In Africa, for instance, children represent 40% of the African population as overall, and however, only 0.6% is actually invested in social protection.
And a new UN report finds that the vast majority of the world's children lack effective social protection coverage. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Renewed fighting has killed 69 people in English-speaking regions of Cameroon, where armed separatists have ordered people to stay inside their homes as the country prepares to celebrate its National Youth Day. February 11th coincides with the 1961 plebiscite, which separatists identify as the day their English-speaking territory was handed to the French-speaking majority. Moki Edwin Kinzika visited the English-speaking towns of Limbe and Boy and filed this report for VOA.
Patients rise and scream on the floor and get little medical attention at the St. Mary Clinic, a private hospital in Cameroon's English-speaking coastal city of Limbe. Nurse Frederick Mengoli says they were dumped there on Friday night by the Cameroon military.
This morning, the military brought 11 wounded patients, and we can't take care of them because our staff is not present, and we don't have the necessary drugs to take care of them. We are just going to clean their wounds. It's a very serious situation.
Fighting has been going on since Tuesday, February 5, in the English-speaking southwestern towns of Limbe, Boya, Motengene, Kumba, Mamfi, and Tombel, as well as in the northwestern towns of Bamenda, Kumbu, Ndop, Nkambe, Bafut, and Kom. That's when armed separatists began what they call a 10-day lockdown, banning many activities in the war-torn Anglophone regions through February 14. They say the ban is intended to disrupt National Youth Day activities to be celebrated on February 11. Here in Boya, hundreds of students from the town's university are shouting as they return home after being forcefully removed from their hostels by the military and locked up for several hours. The military said by staying at home, they were following the separatists instead of obeying government instructions to continue with their activities. 19-year-old journalism student Edmond Bella says they cannot continue their studies because their lives are being threatened by the separatists.
Even the soldiers who are well-armed, well-trained, with sophisticated weapons are still being killed. But they want us to go out. We will not. Who will be able to protect us when the soldiers can't protect themselves?
Some of the students remained in detention. The government says at least 6 military, 47 armed separatists and 16 civilians have been killed. The separatists say on social media they have killed more troops than the government is reporting. Deben Chofo, governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, says troops will continue attacking and killing the armed fighters who disrupt the public peace.
Those that will continue to challenge the state, our security, and foremost the population, are going to be treated accordingly. Soon as the situation will come back to normalcy in our region.
Cameroon celebrates Youth Day every year to encourage young people to renounce violence and other negative behavior. February 11 was chosen because it coincides with the day in 1961 when the United Nations organized a plebiscite in the southern and northern parts of the British-administered Trust Territory in Cameroon. The northern part voted to have independence by joining the Federal Republic of Nigeria, while the southern part, today known as the English-speaking regions of Cameroon, voted to have independence by joining French-speaking Cameroon. Since then, English-speaking Cameroonians have been complaining the UN-sponsored plebiscite did not give them a third option to have an independent state on its own. This resulted in an armed insurgency that started in the English-speaking regions in November 2017 after separatists declared the independence of a nation they called Ambazonia, complaining minority Anglophones were being systematically marginalized in the largely French-speaking country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Limbe, southwestern Cameroon.
In Nigeria, the ruling All Progressives Congress, APC, held its campaign in the commercial capital, Lagos, Saturday. Tens of thousands of party supporters were at the Teslim Bologun Stadium to listen to their leaders, including incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari, Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, and the national chairman of the party, Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu. In his speech, the president promised to jail those who have embezzled public funds. My colleague Peter Kloti is in Lagos to cover the elections and was at the rally and spoke with Mukhtar Maruf, a supporter of the president.
So you are here in Lagos. I see you in the APC apparel. Why do you support the APC and particularly President Muhammadu Buhari?
I am APC member because I see work. PC and APC, you are good working because before, for especially our people, for Lagos State, Hausa people, some people will call you Boko Haram because na PDP work. But now, no more Boko Haram again. Some people, if it's your allergy, your brother, no more fighting again. And the work, if you go to North now, if you follow Kontagora Road, go see APC work. Many work. I believe APC, next 4 years, inshallah, everything will deal.
So you think President Muhammadu Buhari is going to win re-election?
Inshallah, because,
Why do you say so? Because I understand that same people are saying the promises he made before he became president, he's not keeping the promises.
So you try now about security. President Muhammadu Buhari, you try 70%. If you go to Southeast, if you go to Yobe State, Maiduguri, Bauchi, Gombe, now security. And if you go to Kano State and security, they know Buhari try. If we give one more chance, inshallah, everything will go there.
Well, but the people are saying, even here in Lagos, there are so many youth that are unemployed and they don't have jobs that President Muhammadu Buhari promised to give them. And now he is here campaigning in Lagos State for re-election. What is your response to them?
And it's true. Before you promise, you give job to youth. But you try now. You know, say as Nigeria, you have many people. Nigeria is a big country for Africa. So you try now, next 4 years, inshallah, people will go see change.
But people are saying...
They expect change.
People are saying that if for 4 years, that he has promised to give these people jobs and he's not been able to do, but he's only trying, then they should try somebody else, a change perhaps, so the person can also come and do what he can do.
It may give him more chance, inshallah. You go try now. Because I know, say, Nigerian youth, we are too much. You know, say, Buhari, for 4 years, you know, be give anybody work, but may give him more chance now. Everything will, inshallah, will be okay.
So what is your message to the people who have yet to decide on who to vote for on February 16th?
My message to Nigerian people, to vote your right. I don't tell anybody make you choose ABC, but make you choose anything. Either you are, make you try your, the thing either you are mine. But I know say I'll be APC member. I will vote APC, inshallah, we see change. And my family and my wife, na APC. We need change, we go see change, inshallah.
That was Mokhtar Maruf, a supporter of Nigeria's ruling party, All Progressives Congress, APC. He spoke with my colleague Peter Kloti at a political rally in Lagos. A joint study by the International Labour Organization and UN Children's Fund finds the vast majority of the world's children lack effective social protection coverage. It says this dooms them to a life of extreme poverty with negative implications for society. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The study finds only one-third of children between 0 and 14 years of age have any social protection. That means two-thirds, or 1.3 billion children, live without a social safety net. International Labour Organization's Social Protection Department Director, Isabel Ortiz, says just slightly more than 1% of GDP is allocated to social protection for children. She says this huge underinvestment gap needs to be covered.
And of course, the numbers worsen as we go by region. In Africa, for instance, children represent 40% of the African population as overall, and however, only 0.6% is actually invested in social protection for children.
The report finds children fare best in Europe and Central Asia, where 87% have social protection coverage, followed by children in the Americas with 66%. Asia and Africa have the worst records. The report says no data is available on the Arab states. The report highlights the impact extreme poverty has upon the lives of children and the societies in which they live. Chief of the UN Children's Fund Child Poverty and Social Protection Unit, David Stewart, says 385 million children are living on under $1.90 a day.
I think one of the most striking statistics which emerges is that children are two times as likely to be living in poverty as adults. Now, for children, it is particularly concerning because poverty can have a lifetime implication for children. You know, you don't have a second chance at nutrition, at healthcare, and education.
Stewart says this has negative implications for children and for societies and economies as well. The ILO and UNICEF recommend the rapid expansion of social protection for children, including the consideration of universal cash grants to children. Authors of the report say evidence clearly shows cash transfers play a vital role in breaking the vicious cycle of poverty and vulnerability. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Yes, now, in Zimbabwe, migration from rural to urban areas has created a demand for housing, leading to construction on wetlands and concerns about the environment and water supplies. For VOA, Columbus Mavinga has more from Harare.
Conservation groups in Zimbabwe warn that the invasion of the country's wetlands for infrastructure development and stream bank cultivation in urban areas threatens the management of underground water and the availability of the resource. They say the problem has been exacerbated by people moving from rural to urban areas. Those include Zevai Muchichwe, a father of three. Mutshitwe says he built his home on a wetland 3 years ago as Harare battled to contain the migration from the rural parts of the country. Now he says part of the dwelling has cracked and fallen. Mutshitwe says he's waiting for authorities to tell him whether he will be there permanently as the structure needs to be reinforced. He says it was built hurriedly with cheap material, and because of the location, the problem of water underground exists. We thought we'd be here for just a year, he said. Harare authorities say they will soon start water rationing because of low levels. Dorothy Weckling of conservation group Harare Wetlands Trust says she was not surprised by the announcement. She says people are disturbing wetlands which are supposed to be gradually releasing water into the city's water bodies.
If you don't have this and you've got monoculture, all you get is runoff, and you've lost the opportunity for the water to get into the ground, which has been so carefully laid out by nature. It's not there by mistake, and we're discarding it for one plant or buildings when that is the way we get our water. You can't make water come any other way.
The group says it hopes that President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government does not allow construction of the Monavu wetland, which it says holds water for most Harare water bodies. Steady Kangata is from Zimbabwe's environmental agency. Kangata says the agency is working to ensure any disturbance of wetlands and stream banks is at a minimum.
We must not be selfish when it comes to the environment. We are urging anyone who would want to do any form of construction to ascertain the nature as well as the status of the piece of land where they want to undertake the development. The entire world is about the green economy. It's the economy of the environment, where the environment is the pinnacle of any economy, and we should mainstream environmental issues in anything that we do.
For now, Mutshitwe's family and neighbors remain uncertain as to whether they will have a place to stay. Given that the rainy season is not set to end until about late March, they might be sleeping on wet floors. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
A new report says the world produces at least 50 million tons of electronic waste each year, and that number is expected to double 30 years from now. The impact of all that electronic junk is especially felt in Africa. Mohamed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Mobile phones are increasingly common gadgets across Africa. You can get a phone for as little as $10 in the streets of Nairobi. Most Kenyans, however, don't know how to safely dispose of their old phones when they get a new one.
I have a spoiled phone. I've kept it at home. Maybe for future use, or maybe I can decide to dispose it. Yeah, one day. Mostly, if it's not working, I can decide just to throw it away. It depends on how it has spoiled. I throw it away.
It is this kind of behavior that has environmentalists concerned, as many phones, once thrown away, end up in rivers and oceans. The UN Environmental Program estimates that 50 million tons of electronic waste was produced in 2018. It says that number could climb to 120 million tons by the year 2050. One half of so-called e-waste comprises personal devices like computers, smartphones and tablets. Simon Omengo uses an orthodox means to dispose of his electronic gadgets.
Since its motherboard failed, then automatically I disposed. I threw it in the dust in the toilet. I burn it. I break it into pieces because it's useless now to me.
Winnie says the government needs to come up with ways to safely dispose of old devices.
For our government to come up with a place where we can take all the gadgets, especially the phones, which are spoiled, we go and dispose them there, then they'll know how they'll dispose them, rather than just scattering them around. Because some of the people, they just throw them in the dustbin, and you know it is a hazard to the environment.
Experts say electronic devices are becoming complicated to repair and some don't last long. With more devices being thrown away, one Kenya-based group, EnviroServe, is trying to change how Africa's e-waste is managed by stripping down reusable metals and plastics from phones. Some materials remain in Kenya, while other parts like batteries are shipped abroad. Sean Mumford, the head of the company, says old phones were simply dumped in Kenya for years.
It wasn't necessarily being done in a way that is useful, and also it was staying here. So what we're able to do is, instead of Africa being a dumping ground, which has historically, you know, been the case, we're able to deal with what makes sense here and send back out the country the things that need to be dealt with properly.
More than half the population is under the age of 30, and the demand for the latest electronics and dumping the old ones is only growing. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Late last year, South Africa's biggest agricultural union presented the government with a plan to try to avoid it taking land owned by white farmers to give it to black people. This would include allocating land to black farmers with the necessary official financial support to the agricultural sector. South Africa's ruling African National Congress, or ANC, says it will make a constitutional change to open the door for it to expropriate land without compensating its white owners. The Agri's SA organization union says if this happens, it will be disastrous. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC says an amendment to the law is necessary to correct the racial imbalance in land ownership. Almost 25 years after apartheid ended, most big commercial farms still belong to white food producers. Dan Crick is the leader of South Africa's largest agricultural group, AgriSA, which represents thousands of white and black farmers.
We have to acknowledge the devastating effect of colonialism, the 1913 Land Act, and apartheid on the lives of black people in this country.
Using these policies, racist governments made sure that whites farmed the best soil. Crick says AgriSA agrees this cannot continue.
The people on the ground are losing patience, and we are all at risk. If their patience run out, then we are all in trouble. That's the political dilemma.
Pockets of poor people have already started invading land, but state security forces have moved fast to quell the incidents. Crick says the political solution to the land question is for white farmers to help to restore the dignity of their black colleagues.
And how are we going to do that? We're going to take hands. I'm extending a hand of friendship from AgriSA and all the farmers here to government and say we want to partner with you, we want to collaborate, we want to see consensus, and we want to take this country forward.
He and the leaders of smaller groups representing organized agriculture have signed a declaration taking responsibility for land reform. But in the meantime, says Crick, confusing statements from the ANC about land are fueling economic uncertainty.
That is not good for our economy. It is not good for internal and external investors. We are trapped in a low growth curve, and we need to do something about it. We need to instill confidence in the South African economy.
AgriSA says the opposite will happen if the state confiscates white farmers' land. Crick adds that farm seizures will also threaten food security across Southern Africa. He says AgriSA will soon present government with a strategy for organized agriculture to provide land for housing in urban areas, land for industrialization, and land for black farmers.
We need more black farmers on more black farms, and we can do that in a responsible way, in a legal way, in a sustainable way, in a developmental way, without unsettling the balances in South Africa that we so desperately need, without scaring people. We cannot expropriate ourselves out of trouble. We've got to develop ourselves out of trouble.
Make no mistake, says Crick, South Africa is in trouble. Experts blame the rapid fall of the rand and an economic recession partly on the ANC's plan to seize land, and on the fringes of growing inequality and poverty are the radicals, poised to either incite black people to invade land or to urge white farmers to resist. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America in Washington, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the second part of the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah and our Sunday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And now in Nightline Africa Sports, we start with football. CAF President Ahmad is facing a threat to his reign after being accused of violating the statutes of African football's ruling body. Executive Committee member Moussa Bellete called for an urgent Executive Committee meeting on Friday. He wants Ahmad's decisions to redistribute the 2021, 2023 and 2025 Africa Cup of Nations and signing a commercial deal without Executive Committee approval to be assessed. CAF's statutes rule that only 8 of the Executive Committee's 23 members need to be present for such a meeting to go ahead. Should the Executive Committee find Ahmad guilty of breaching CAF statutes, which state that moving any nation's cup requires the approval of the Executive Committee, the former Madagascar FA president could be suspended from his role and ultimately expelled. Bellete maintains that Ahmed violated the CAF statutes when choosing to reassign hosting rights for three nations' cups without Executive Committee approval. Shortly after Cameroon was stripped of hosting the 2019 edition in November because of slow preparations, Ahmed offered the same country the chance to stage the 2021 finals, which Ivory Coast had been set to stage. The CAF president revealed the offer on December 3rd, prompting Ivory Coast to launch a legal challenge with the Court of Arbitration for Sport just days later, before CAF itself issued a statement to say that no decision had been made with regard to changing the 2021 hosts. Cameroon eventually accepted to host the 2021 finals, with Ivory Coast then agreeing to stage the 2023 edition instead of 2021, and Guinea also choosing to stage 2 years later, 2025 instead of 2021. Ahmed's term of office is set to expire in 2021. Meanwhile, Nigeria and South Africa qualified for this year's Under-20 World Cup in Poland in May after both teams secured victories in their final group games at the Under-21 Africa Cup of Nations in Niger on Friday. The results also put Nigeria and South Africa into the semi-finals of the Under-20 Nations Cup. Nigeria beat hosts Niger 1-0 in Niamey thanks to a 73rd-minute strike from Ibrahim Al-Hassan to reach the semi-finals. South Africa secured their place with a 1-0 win over Burundi at the Stade de Maradi after Luc Leroux converted a penalty in the 9th minute. Nigeria finished top of Group A on 7 points, with South Africa second on 5 points. Host Niger were third on 2 points, with Burundi finishing bottom of the standings on 1 point. Senegal were the first team to qualify for the World Cup from Niger 2019 after their 2-0 win over Ghana on Thursday. And the Somali Football Federation has announced that its under-20 team will host Eritrea's under-20s in a friendly match in Mogadishu on February 16th. The match at the Banadia Stadium will be the first international football game at any level in Somalia for more than 30 years. Security concerns mean Somalia have had to play at neutral venues or away from home. The Somali Football Federation president, Abdikan Said Arab, reportedly said in his words, "In the near future, we could host a SECAFA regional tournament." Arab, who is also the vice president of East and Central African Regional Body, SECAFA, said they will start with hosting teams from the region first before opening up to the rest. The country last hosted an international in 1988 when Somalia played Mauritius in an Olympic qualifier in Mogadishu. Somali soccer has made steady development over the years despite the country's instability. Since 2015, the Somali FA installed an artificial turf at Mogadishu Stadium and also played the league game for the first time in over 30 years in 2017. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sport. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Friday night, I'm wasted. The night feels amazing. The boy needs to wind down. I don't need the basics. I see a fine booty. Excuse me, no need to be rude. You seem lonely, you coolie. You don't have to be moody. You're sweetie like Muscatella. Tell me why would you cheer up? You're one of a kind, I'm one of a kind. It takes two to enjoy up. I see you like movie or hipster. Mr. Kuvi, Mobito. She waste my time, I don't mind. All I need is your name and your number. I drink it, she drink it, we get it so naughty. Next thing I know, she dey feel on my body. As long as she's with it, there's no need to worry. She cool and I'm cool, but I'm feeling some more heat. Your sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Your sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got me spending cheddar.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
Oh gosh, she all I savor. Wake up, let's roll. Let's make the Sierra party. Disco invasion, naughty. Who? I'm from the 80s, mommy. I can't deny there's something. Fishing for you is gravy. I think I caught me something. Oh, go, go way up into the heavens. Winds got us high, dancing with angels. I feel the vibe, I think I'm high. I'll show you how a man can get it down. Brace for a ride.
I drink it, she drink it, we get it so naughty. Next thing I know, she the feel on my body. As long as she's with it, there's no need to worry. She cool and I'm cool, but I'm feeling some more heat. Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got me spending cheddar.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
Oh gosh, she all I see. Oh, go, go way up into the heavens. Winds got us high, dancing with angels. I feel the vibe, I think I'm high. I'll show you how a man can get it down. Brace for a ride.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got me spending cheddar.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
She's got a wicked flavor.
Sweetie like Muscatella.
Oh gosh, she a lifesaver.
Mapaje, yeah. Uva kuyambere, ugeza kuyanyuma. Narebe uko wiyumva, yeah, yeah. Amatsiko agashira, amarira agashira, ugatuza, yeah, yeah. I find myself on your door. I'm begging, begging, I'm begging, begging my love. Do you believe me, girl? Mbaye wowe, matenga yashira. Kwizera urwongo ukunda. Mbaye wowe.
Mbaye wowe, amatenga yashira. Nakwizera urwongo ukunda. Mbaye wowe.
Imungenge zashira.
Oh, I'm gonna go to the Sigana tu vikana tu tabusanya yaba wareba gamu mutima inukunda zashira ubwo babugashira ugatuza tukabana baby
I found myself on your door I'm begging begging I'm begging begging my love do you believe me boy
why you Shira, kwizera urwo ngukunda, mbaye wowe,
mbaye wowe, amakenga yashira, nakwizera urwo ngukunda, mbaye wowe,
imungenge zashira,
ufite
kwigashira,
ukunze urwo ngukunda, mbaye wowe.
Angejo, ni mizo nejo
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The 32nd ordinary session of the Assembly of Heads of State and Government of the African Union, AU, is currently being held at its headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The theme of this summit is refugees, returnees, an internally displaced person towards durable solutions to forced displacement in Africa. In contrast to many other regions of the world, Africa, in cooperation with the United Nations, has been able to handle the problems of refugees satisfactorily. According to the United Nations Refugees Organization, UNHCR, 26% of the world's refugee populations are hosted in Africa, mainly in southern and eastern Africa, because of ongoing conflicts in Somalia, in South Sudan, in Zimbabwe, and other parts of Africa. The African governments, in cooperation with the UN, has been able to meet the needs of these refugees, even though for many of these refugees it is uncomfortable. One government, in particular Uganda, has devised rules and regulations which enable refugees to feel more at home in the country. The problem is more about the returnees. How do you return refugees to their home countries? In accordance with United Nations rules, refugees can only be returned with their consent, and the United Nations must be convinced that the place of return is free of danger and harm to them. So this is where you have some problems. Internally displaced persons are now being taken care of, but not in the past years, because when people are displaced internally, it is the responsibility of the government. Quite often, these governments do not have the resources to take care of these IDPs, as they are called. So more and more, the international community has been coming in to help many of these countries. Now, the African Union will be discussing durable solutions. That means you have to resolve the issues which propelled the refugees' outflow. And here, Africa has been taking some very good steps. The African Union itself has just been able to work out a solution in the Central African Republic, which is being looked at and may hold promise to solving that problem which has caused many, many, many refugees. Similarly, reports now being received show that the situation in South Sudan is being stabilized, and people are feeling that this time maybe the peace agreement will hold and the people will find it comfortable and suitable to begin to return home. Similarly, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where there are lots of refugees in neighboring countries. We have just witnessed a peaceful change of government, and there are possibilities that with the passage of time, these solutions will be found to some of the fighting, particularly in the eastern parts of the DRC. The new president, Tshisekedi, has already been making the rounds in the neighboring countries. He has paid a visit to Luanda, Angola, to introduce himself. But one must remember that sometime in November and December last year, a large number of DRC countrymen and women were being forced to return to the DRC. So the contact he's making with the government in Luanda is to see that things are stabilized. Tshisekedi has also paid a visit to Congo Brazzaville, and perhaps most importantly, he has paid a visit to Nairobi to have discussion with the government there, trying to see whether the eastern part of the Congo can be stabilized. So Africans are really taking useful steps to stabilize and to make durable the reduction of refugees in the African continent. Attending the summit also will be the Secretary General of the United Nations, Guterres. According to his spokesman in New York last week, the Secretary General will try to strengthen the cooperation between the United Nations and Africa. Last year, there was an open meeting of the Security Council where the topic really was how to strengthen cooperation between the Security Council and the African Union in peace and security, particularly peacekeeping and peacemaking. While there were very nice statements made, nothing concrete has been made with respect to peacekeeping. It has been a long-term African request that the international community through the United Nations provide funding and logistics to African peacekeeping. Thus far, the Security Council has not been able to work out an arrangement to make this possible. But in other areas, the United Nations have strengthened its cooperation with the African Union and Africa. Let us hope that this current summit is able to make much progress, because Africa needs all the people it could use for its development. And any durable solutions to forced displacement in Africa will be welcomed by the African people as a whole. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From all of us here at Nightline Africa, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Producer Saida Hamdon, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.